solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
So the most important question is why, then how, then what? The country cousins somewhere not important are when and where. The problem with this when it comes to eliciting stories is the why, how, and what are opinion generating questions. Why do projects go wrong in this company? You're not going to get a story. You'll say because of, you know, they are underfunded or don't have management oversight. Yeah. Or how do you choose a great trainer? Mm-hmm. Oh, you choose a great trainer by doing ABC. No stories. But if I were to turn this pyramid and put the why, when and where question is the most important. So where was the, or when was the last time you actually got the right trainer? And how did it happen? That'll take you to a moment in time and get me a story. Where did you last see great application of knowledge? It'll take you a moment in time and get a story. This process of asking questions that take you to a moment in time and get a story is what we call story listening.
Welcome to the 37th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations with leaders across disciplines on topics around leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, your host and curator of this podcast series. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders during high-stakes transition, whether it's a role transition, leadership transition in a company, or a career transition in an individual's life. To know more about the advisory work I do, you could visit transitioninsight.com. I believe that just like businesses need to be coherent about their answers to where to play and how to win, we all need to be thoughtful about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow. This podcast is an attempt at exploring how some leaders across domains have grappled with these two questions as they've gone on their respective journeys. My guest this time is Indraneel Chakraborty, a professional who specializes in business storytelling. He's recently written a book titled Stories at Work, Unlock the Secret to Business Storytelling. The book is published by Penguin Random House and is available at all the usual online and offline bookstores. The more I think about it, storytelling is such a critical skill for all of us to develop, and it can have a transformational impact at work and at home. More specifically, this conversation is likely to be relevant for entrepreneurs who are trying to build a certain culture, CEOs who are trying to transmit their strategy into their company, or parents who are trying to get their point across to their children, just to underscore the three constituents who might seek value from this conversation. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Indraneel. Indraneel, thank you so much for taking time and for coming on the podcast. Excited to be talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe a good place to start is talking about what you do and why you do what you do. Give us a sense of what your day gets filled with.
Okay. So what do? I help leaders and organizations harness the power of stories to ensure that the communication is more impactful, more memorable. Basically helping them connect better, engage better, inspire more, using the power of stories. So that's a very top-level thing of what I do.
Mm-hmm. And maybe talking about your journey, Indraneel, I want to take you back to the point in time, let's say early 2013, you were the chief marketing officer of Mahindra Holidays, and you decided to take the plunge and start Storyworks. So talk to us a little bit about that transition. How did you take the decision, and what gave you the conviction this was a plunge that made sense for you?
Okay, yeah, that's been an interesting journey. So the year was 2011 when Mahindra Holidays decided to do something very different, in the sense that they uprooted their head office, which was in Chennai, and brought it to Mumbai, to Mahindra Towers. They had a transition of CEOs. The new CEO transited a lot of people in the leadership team. So we were all very new. A good thing to do when you're new is to decide that everything everyone has done before you is is not up to the mark, so you change everything. Now, I was head of strategy and marketing, so I was there to change the strategy of the company, the vision, the mission, the brand, the logo, and all that. And one of the things we had to do is to rewrite, let's say, the vision and mission. Now, I've always found vision and mission to be a funny thing because I, for most companies, it to me reads like a scorecard. Not something that I would want to come to office Monday morning. I mean, we want to be the third largest insurance firm by 2020. Yeah, that's a scorecard. So instead of vision and mission, I came up with something I called the credo. Our credo was making every moment magical. It seemed to tick all the boxes. It was inspirational. We thought it was. It was measurable. It worked for the CEO. It worked for the janitor. The next question was, how do you ensure that everyone, all employees across Mahindra Holidays, is delivering magical moments? So we needed some guidelines for behavior. And the HR guy rightly said, but that's values. Yeah. And like most other companies, we had something on the wall which said things like integrity and sustainability and stuff like that. And my thing was that even if the employees maxed out on each of those, we won't be able to deliver magical moments. Because to me, for most companies, these values are really table stakes today. They might have been a time where they could be a more ethical company and less ethical company. Today, you can't be not an ethical company. That's not a choice. So to me, I call them, hygiene values, not winning values. And I needed winning values, values that will help employees deliver magical moments. Of course, the problem was no one had the guts to go to Anand Mahindra and say integrity is no longer a value. So we created a new piece of document, which we called the Code of Conduct, and moved all this integrity, sustainable, all that into that piece of paper, table stakes. And in the blank piece of paper, we wrote down things like no room for ordinary. Why? Because ordinary can't be magical. We said experience is everything. Why? Because half the company, which are the guys in sales, were tapping people like you and me in the mall and saying five-star holiday. Now, what is five-star holiday? I mean, we're not technically five-star. Yeah, and even if we were, what does that mean to a consumer? And I said, we need to sell experiences. And then I went to the other side of the company, which is the resorts. We had people from, the Tajs, the Oberoi's running these resorts. And I went and told them, we need a differential experience. And they said, sure, give us more inches. More inches of TV, more inches of mattress. And I was trying to tell them that, a hard bed in a treehouse might be the most magical experience. And so experiences, everything became the second, and so on and so forth. Now, all that worked in the head office. Everyone got it. Everyone is actually very proud of it. We even won a few awards within the group for the kind of values we had. But what went into my head was this funny place which said, oh my God, maybe I have made another poster. How do you ensure that values are understood by everyone across the country, across the company? Yeah. And it's not about translation. How does the, let's say, housekeeping boy in Himachal understand no room for ordinary? And I had no answer. I read, I wrote to people, I asked questions. But finally, what I found out is that you run workshops. So I ran workshops and made lots of posters, t-shirts, coffee cups. Nothing seems to have worked. And in that search, I don't know what I searched, but I searched something on Google once and I landed upon the blog of a guy called Sean Callahan. Sean had this little company in Australia called Anecdote. And he talked about how stories can help abstract things become concrete. And it seemed to make sense. And I was lucky because Sean and his business partner, Mark, were visiting India in the next 3 months. I went and spent 2 days with them when they were in Delhi. And they taught me narrative work. Yeah. And what they said was that when you are looking at things that are abstract, instead of writing more abstract lines to explain that abstract word, use stories to make them concrete. Yeah. So he said, go collect stories from the organization of what people in the organization think is that value being lived. Yeah. And he said, when you collect those stories, 80% of the stories will be junk because people don't understand that value. But you'll find 20% of the stories which are absolutely what you meant. And they also taught me how to collect stories, because if you go and tell a person, tell me a story of no room for ordinary, they don't know how to react. So having learned that, when I came back, every time I visited a branch, a sales branch or the resort, I got people together and I did what I call story listening, which is collecting stories. And I came back, of course, like Sean had predicted, with 80% junk. Let me give you a junk example. So this housekeeping boy in Rajasthan is telling me, "Sir, one day an extra large family came to the resort." So I said, "What is an extra large family?" He said, "Sir, 4 children and mother, father. And the parents wanted 2 extra towels." And then the children started demanding 2 extra towels. I didn't say anything and I provided 18 towels in one room. And that's no room for ordinary. Now, he wasn't pulling my leg. He genuinely believed that instead of 4 towels, you gave 18 towels with a smile. Is his understanding. That's not what I had in mind. Because that is not a magical moment when you get 2 extra towels. But in all this junk, you get stories like the one I've written in the book about, which is was told to me by a receptionist at the Coorg Resort. And he talks about his colleague who gets a call from a member and takes the message, and then he calls the lunchroom. And when the colleague is talking to the lunchroom, the other guy, the storyteller, overhears this. And his colleague tells the lunchroom that member is coming with 2 children and his wife, and they're stuck in traffic. They can't make it for the lunch service. Can we pack some lunch boxes and keep? When this guy overhears, he asks, "Hey, did you ask the member which route he's coming from?" He said, "Yeah, that route." He said, "Call the dining hall again." He said, "Why?" "Tell them to pack some tea and cakes." He said, "Why?" He said, "Don't you know there is a flower show that will be inaugurated by the local politician? The police have blocked that road. There is no way these members are going to come back by 6 o'clock. So he says, "Oh my God, there are children in the car." Half an hour later, the shift gets over. This guy, without telling anyone, without taking any permission, goes to the lunchroom, picks up those lunch boxes, ties it up on his bike, travels through some interior roads for 8-9 kilometers, keeps calling the member's mobile, locates the car, and goes and gives the boxes and says, "Your children must be hungry." And that is living the value, no room for ordinary. And suddenly people get it. Because what you did with that is you converted something abstract, no room for ordinary, into something concrete, because stories are concrete. And then, of course, you need to tell those stories. So we rejigged our entire process of, let's say, induction program. Every company that I know of, I've worked with, has an induction program, which has one section called values. And in those values, you take abstract words and then explain it with more abstract. So you take an English word and use more English word to explain that English word. I won't name companies, but companies with the word in the value statement called stewardship. What does stewardship mean? Or even something as simple as respect. And everyone thinks, yeah, I know what respect is. I've worked with companies when I've asked questions, so tell me about respect. Give me an example of respect in your company. "Oh, sir, we respect people very much." I said, "I understand. Give me an example." He said, "Last year, when I overshot my target in November itself, my CEO called me and personally congratulated me. He treated me with respect." No, he didn't. He gave you recognition. That's not respect. So that's what the problem with abstraction is. And so we redesigned our induction programs, etc. And every speech that any senior leader gave, if he ever opened his mouth to say, "We believe in," he had to support it with a story. Yeah. And the transition that I saw was magical. 1 year of my trying everything was not working. And now suddenly people were getting it. I won't say hundreds, but over the next 2-3 months, I got at least 7-8 stories from the system, which showed me people are getting it. And that's when I was also, I mean, you know, when you look backwards, a lot of dots connect. I was looking at many things happening in my head, and this gave me an opportunity to step out and do something on my own. So that's really how I got into storytelling.
So really, let's jump into the book. Congrats on the book and the initial success in the first few weeks.
Thank you.
You use the term business storytelling. And again, for the purpose of listeners of this podcast, I'd love for you to expand on the nuance here. How is it different from storytelling?
Interesting. So let me take two sides of the spectrum. So if you were to draw an axis, on one end of that spectrum is what I call big S storytelling. Yeah. Big S storytelling is the usual storytelling that we are aware of. Whether you take the Ramayana or the Mahabharata or Dilwale Dulhaniya Le Jayenge or Harry Potter. Yeah. I don't operate anywhere there. For me, business storytelling is at the other extreme. This is little stories, little recounts, recount of experiences you've had, all of which can be very powerfully brought in to make a point during business, you know, business conversations, etc. So to me, that is business storytelling. Business storytelling is harnessing it in the context of business. The critical differences to me are, A, the amount of detail that you need to get into any story when you're in business needs to be only what is required to drive home that point and nothing more. So there is a whole lot of work that you need to do to make sure that you don't keep back in the story stuff that you like, which need not be important for delivering that message very clearly. Yeah. Whereas if you're doing it in the bar, you can be rambling a bit and adding things that are not there. The second big difference to me is storytelling in business needs to be for a reason, a business reason. There must be a reason why you're telling that story. You're trying to make a point, you're trying to illustrate something, you're trying to deliver something in a way that is more memorable. In a bar, you could walk in and say, hey, let me tell you a story. Why? Because I heard a great story. Now, you can't do that in business. And the last thing is, because it is business, and this is where I think I differ from the new generation of business storytellers that have arrived in the last 5 years, is I believe that business storytelling doesn't have anything to do with things like voice modulation. Now, very often, you know, the learning and development person in companies I work with, they look at the agenda of my workshop and say, where is voice modulation? And my answer is in the theater. Yeah. For some reason, in this country, a lot of public speaking training and now storytelling training is done by people from theater. Now, while they are good at theater, we are not going to be doing theater in the boardroom. Yeah. We need to be in boardroom talking like you usually do in boardroom, because otherwise it is going to stand out. And one of the things that we have to understand is that no matter how convinced you are about the power of stories in business, there is a huge wall between business and storytelling. And the reason it is there is the labels we have for stories. Stories are made up. Stories are for entertainment. Stories are largely for children. Exactly the opposite of what we are in business. Stories are facts. Business is fact. Business is about only sticking to the point. I mean, how many of us have not had this situation where we've been trying to explain why something hasn't happened and the boss has said, kahani mat batao. Yeah, what does that mean? Kahani is a bad word. Now, which is why when you bring stories into business, your story has to be invisible. What I mean by that is when someone is listening to your story, he can't be saying, I'm telling a story. Because as soon as your brain figures out you're telling a story and then it figures out, oh, it's the boardroom, you think, oh, what an idiot.
The walls come up.
Yeah. Mm. So that's, to me, some of the key differences between storytelling and business storytelling.
And where do you see the line between brevity and storytelling? Again, the other piece that people talk about in businesses,
I don't have time for a story.
In a sense, I grew up in the consulting world where there was a lot of emphasis on less is more. You know, few points, be pithy, be to the point. So brevity was something that was celebrated. Do you see a trade-off there, or
not
is
at
that
all.
A false trade-off?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, one of the key things I teach, and the book also talks about it, is brevity in storytelling.
And say more. I mean,
so what happens is when you have a story to tell, and because why are we doing storytelling in business? We are trying to harness three big powers of story. One is stories are easy to understand. Stories are easy to remember, and stories are easy to retell. Some of the things that you do not get in a business situation. How many offsites have you been to where the CEO or some senior leader has explained the next year's strategy? And then when people have come back and their teams have said, boss, what was discussed in Goa? He said, strategy for next year. What is the strategy? Oh, one PowerPoint will come. Why is it not repeatable? Because all that hours of so-called business clear with lots of brevity has not landed, right? Now, when you use stories or story structures, yeah, you get that power and you can do it in that same amount of time you would have otherwise taken, because in many cases, because of the layers of different English lines and sentences you're trying to use to explain something very simple, can be done with a story actually sometimes even shorter. So I don't see any fight between brevity, the desire for brevity and storytelling. In fact, in the work in storytelling, one of the critical things is brevity. Because brevity is best delivered when there is simplicity in communication. And I love a Leonardo da Vinci quote which said, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Yeah. And so when you are able to get very simple with your message, you're not going to be long with it. But that simple, tight story will deliver much more than what a long paragraph of a lot of huge English words would have managed to do.
Got it. In the book, you also talk about four different applications of storytelling. Building a rapport, explaining change, handling mental blocks, and sharing best practices. Talk to us a little bit about how the storytelling approach is nuanced in each of these contexts. How is it different in each of these contexts?
Okay. So this is not necessarily the, mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive sort of area where you can use storytelling. To me, these are the building blocks I start with to get people comfortable into their journey of storytelling. So I keep talking about this both in the book and any of my keynotes or training programs, is that I don't do the art of storytelling. Is there an art to storytelling? Of course there is. You don't need it in business. Not till you're doing something like I do with, let's say I do a 3-hour keynote. That's a long keynote. You need a bit of art there. But for almost all business conversations, none of them are 3-hour keynotes, you don't need art. You can do with science. And what is science? Science to me is process, repeatable, measurable, predictable. So if you did A, B, C and got D today, someone else should be able to do A, B, C and get D tomorrow. So in order to get that kind of stuff, what I have done is I've looked at 3-4 areas. You took 4 of them. I have 5 in my head, which are important for us in business, where currently we have a challenge. And I've put in together a process for each one of them and said, in this situation, if you do A, B, C, you'll get a powerful story to use. Mm-hmm. Now, is it going to be that regimented all your life? No, not at all. To me, the way I look at this is that this is like what I call my balance wheels of business storytelling. You know, when you and I learned how to cycle, we got up on a cycle, fell, grazed our knees, got up. Our children learn with these 2 training wheels of storytelling. Fantastic stuff. You don't fall off. You don't bruise. Similarly, in the business context, the way I see it is you don't make mistakes and hence bruise your ego and then throw out storytelling. This will help you get your storytelling going. After the first, most of my training programs, we work for 6 months. And people who read the book, I talk about locked about practice in the book. And I say, after you've got good at this, throw away those training wheels. Then you can do your wheelies, your stunts, your skids. So these are just getting the sort of rules right. And what we've done there is looked at 4 areas which are powerful and important, and we have a challenge. So the first one is building a relationship, building a rapport. We know that what builds rapport is who we are, our character. Yet whenever we get the chance to introduce ourselves, we only use credentials. And one of the reasons that might happen is because it's easy to come and say, hi, I'm a computer science engineer from so-and-so place, and you'll believe me. But I can't come and say, hi, I'm very trustworthy. Doesn't work. And so we have a challenge, which is one, we know that for people to build relationship with us or people to buy us before they buy our product, idea, or service, they need to know who we are. Yet we use credentials. The story way bridges the gap. And so what is this? This I call a connection story. It's tiny anecdotes from your life, which when blended into your initial conversation, sometimes into your introduction, can leave the listener with an inference of who you are and what you stand for. So that's one area. Yeah. We then talk about, so this is one of those out of the 4, which is actually a story. The rest of them are not stories as much as story structures. Yeah. So we take...
And what's the distinction there?
A story is a story. Let's we can sort of break that up if you want. But I guess most people understand what a story is. Now, a story has a structure, which means it has a, if you take the basic structure of a story, which is called the story mountain or the Freytag triangle, you start with exposition, which is setting up the context, setting up the background. Then you set up the challenge, or it's called the rising action or the rising tension. Then you reach a place where you don't know whether it's going to work or not going to work, and it's called the climax. Then you have the solution that has come, and then you have the falling tension or the falling action, and finally conclusion. That's the very basic story structure. What we've done in the next few areas, which is when we're trying to do change messaging, we're only trying to change people's mind or sharing success, we've used these various story structures to craft our messages. I do a lot of consulting work as well, using stories. So one of the big areas of work that I do is helping organizations when they are coming up with change messages like new strategy, new vision, transformation. And what I do with the team is help them craft their transformation or strategy like a story. So I'm not writing a story about the strategy. I'm writing the strategy like a story. Yeah. And the structure I use is what in the book we've covered called the clarity story. And the same thing, another structure to change people's mind, another structure to share success.
Got it. The other thing that caught my attention in the book, Indraneel, was the point you make about tappers and listeners. As somebody who's passionate about music, I found the example quite interesting. You talk about an experiment where there's an asymmetry of knowledge or information, and you relate that to why PowerPoints sometimes are not as effective. Talk to us about the nuance here.
Okay. So I'm going to tap a tune on the table. You're a musician, so I think you'll get it. And I'm going to ask you to tell me what is the song that I just tapped. Yeah, so let's try.
Give me some genre or...
Okay, it's a very popular English song and you learnt it in your early days in school.
Okay.
Right? Come on, you didn't get it. It's Jingle Bell, Jingle Bell. Now, what just happened? The reason I got it is because the tune was in my head. And when the tune is in my head, that sounds like Jingle Bell to me. When the tune is not in your head, that sounds like noise. Yeah. And that's really the experiment that Elizabeth Newton, who was doing her studies in Stanford, did. In fact, she went on to become a professor in Harvard later. So she did this experiment where she took 240 students and divided them into two groups. One group she called tappers, and their job was to do what I just did, tap on a table. The other group was called decoders or listeners, and their job was to guess the tapping. Yeah. And then she told the entire group that, listen, this group of tappers, I'm going to give them a list of very popular English songs, songs that everybody knows, Jingle Bell, Happy Birthday, Merry Christmas. And they will randomly pick up a song, and you guys will decode the song. Here's a piece of paper and pen. You will not tell them what you guessed. And I'm going to make you guys into pairs and send you out. When they came back, she asked the tappers individually, how did it go? And the usual answer, I think it went off well. Why do you think it went off well? Ah, it's such an easy song. Everyone knows the song. Yeah. And I think I did a decent job of tapping. When asked what percentage of you are 100% sure that your partner got it, the usual answer was about 60 to 70%. Then she would go over to the listeners and take their paperwork, which was the guess that they had, and tabulated the result. And on an average, less than 2% or 2.5% ever got it.
That's a pretty pretty small number, huh?
And that also, I think, is just random. Yeah, you just got it right. And this is exactly what she says, which is basically what she's saying when she's saying curse of knowledge, is when the tune is in my head, we just demonstrated with Jingle Bell, I know it's working. But when the tune is not in your head, that's noise. So to me, the analogy, that was the morning I read this, it was my epiphany, you know, my eureka moment. And I said, oh my God, for the last 8-10 years in my corporate life, when I was senior enough to come up with strategy, vision, mission, and stuff like that, I did not come up with it in the morning of the offsite. I had worked with for weeks, if not months, with my team, sometimes with a Bain or McKinsey. And by the time I came to the stage, that tune was running in my head. And I walked up on stage and did the corporate version of tapping, which is bullet points on a PowerPoint. And I came off stage thinking, you know, easy song, decent tapper. They must have got it. And then 7 days later, I'm tearing my hair saying, you know, why don't they get it? And now, of course, the favorite whipping boy is millennials. There's nothing wrong with millennials or anyone. It's wrong with the way we've structured our communication. Half of it is in our head, and we think everyone has that in theirs as well.
Got it. Fascinating. So I think the takeaway from this is, again, linking it back to storytelling. Again, if you could sort of maybe talk a little bit about what's the so what?
So what is that one of the big issues that we have when we're doing this is the context where we are coming from is assumed, whereas the context that the listener has is not the same as the one that the teller has. Now, when you just craft your messages, you tend to jump to the message without the context, without the why. I'm thinking that, you know, these are your company people, these are your team people, so you don't really need to explain. When you then are forced to take this message and put it into a story structure, that automatically forces you to set context. You can't tell a story without a context. And so when you bring the message into a structure of a story, you will start with exposition, setting up the base before jumping into the action. And so that's the analogy.
Got it. I want to jump to another term that you use in the book, Indraneel, story listening. Again, that's the first time I came across the term. I've heard listening, but story listening was interesting. So again, talk to us about what's the nuance here. I think you talk about how we should frame our questions so that we elicit a rich story. So give us a sense of story listening and how it's different from listening in general.
So the person to credit with the word story listening is Sean Callahan. It's a term he coined. It's basically says, how do you collect stories? And the reason we need to be looking at this differently from just the obvious, which is just go and say, tell me a story, because tell me a story in a business context doesn't work. Yeah. So if I come to you saying, tell me a story of great application of knowledge. Now you're going to look at me and say, what did you smoke last night? Yeah. Whereas you do have various examples from your work life of great application of knowledge. I'm sure you have. Now, I need to frame questions in a way that will help you really go back to a moment in time, because that's where memories are, right? A moment in time. So the kind of questions that you need to phrase should take you there. So one of the things that would take you there is if I tell you another story, which is about application of knowledge. So I say, you know, Deepak, in this company, they had this, what a brilliant application of knowledge. Sometimes stories trigger stories because you remember another moment in time where something like that happened. So one way to elicit stories is to tell another story. Another way to elicit stories is to actually turn the story pyramid upside down. What is the story pyramid? And you've been in McKinsey, so I'm sure you've read the whole book, which is the most important question is why. Yeah.
Pyramid
then,
principle.
And then how? No, this is not the pyramid principle. This is basically saying the question pyramid. So the most important question is why, then how, then what. The country cousins somewhere not important are when and where. The problem with this when it comes to eliciting stories is the why, how, and what are opinion generating questions. Why do projects go wrong in this company? You're not going to get a story. You'll say because of, you know, they are underfunded or don't have management oversight. Yeah. Or how do you choose a great trainer? Mm-hmm. Oh, you choose a great trainer by doing ABC. No stories. But if I were to turn this pyramid and put the why, when and where question is the most important. So when was the last time you actually got the right trainer? And how did it happen? That'll take you to a moment in time and get me a story. Where did you last see great application of knowledge? It'll take you a moment in time and get a story. This process of asking questions that take you to a moment in time and get a story is what we call story listening.
Very interesting. And how do you, again, maybe wearing a consultant's hat here, sometimes when you ask the why question or the what question, you're expecting people to process multiple stories and come up with the net insight. And sometimes asking them to throw up a data point might, you know, deprive you of that aggregated insight. Is there a loss there?
So I don't think this is a either or situation. There are times where I might want to, and I'm sure there are many times when I want to ask the why question, where I want you to aggregate your understanding. There are times when I want an individual example. Now, one of the things that I think is grossly misused in business, and I've been told this for many, many times as a marketer, and I wish I had the answers I have now. You know, I would go for a market visit. I would come back very excited about an observation, and I would table it saying, you know, what I saw, this was this. And then some senior guy would say, there is no room for anecdotal evidence. Yeah, we need data. Yeah. I wish I had the definition that I have now. My new definition is, data is nothing but a plural of anecdote. Yeah. And so there's nothing wrong with looking at those individual stuff, because the richness is in the individual stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. When you give me your why, I don't always have the reason why you've come to that why. If I have to understand how you've come to that why, I need to go behind and look at some of those individual stuff. So again, I don't think it's either or.
Fair.
It's when you want that richness, the texture of where that final opinion comes from, that a story listening might be more important.
Got it. And now, again, maybe this is a question from the line of work I'm into, let's say story listening and coaching. Again, you don't discuss that explicitly in the book, but I guess each individual life is so unique and so nuanced. And so much of who we are and why we do what we do is contextual. As a coach, I'm curious about how we can leverage the power of stories to understand another human being.
That's a very good question. By the way, I too am a ICF certified coach. I don't talk about it too much. And that's only because I personally think that, you know, when people meet people, they need to put them in boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. To handle. And if I say that I'm this and that and this, they don't know which box to put me in. I'd rather at this point occupy the storytelling box. Now, I think one is, and you know this because you're practicing this so much, is the power of listening is the difference between so many things. Yeah. Now, the thing is that if I take the, what would I do with my new knowledge of story listening in coaching is really ask people to make real their opinions. So if they came and said, you know, I don't want to do this because my boss is judging me, that's an opinion, right? If I go back and say, give me an example of your boss judging you, then I know exactly what he means. Because remember, again, A, language is complex. B, most of us are not even native English speakers. The word judging me may mean two different things to the coacher and the coachee.
Yeah.
And so if you jump into conclusion saying, oh, that's what he means by boss is judging, you are now listening for that kind of judgment, which is different from what he thinks is judging. If you can make that real, so you're not only listening to the fact that he's saying the boss was judging, but you're listening to the reality behind that statement of boss is judging. And then you're on the same concreteness.
Understood. And I think again, talking more on the home front, your book also got me reflecting on the impact stories can have in one's family life, right? As a father of two young kids, I was just wondering, it's just such a powerful way of getting messages across.
Absolutely.
Rather than telling them things. Again, this is possibly not related to business storytelling, but maybe a quick detour. Any quick insights on, what the leaders can learn in applying stories to their home context?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not just home. It's about communication.
Mm.
Yeah? So if I were to bring this to the crux, it's something that I just mentioned a little earlier, which is what stories are doing is making things real. Yeah. So when you go and tell people, you need to work hard to succeed, that's abstract. Both hard work, success, and the relationship between the two. Now, why do you have that opinion? All the opinion that you give your kids in business or in society, where did those opinions come from? You were not born with those opinions. Yeah? Your opinion came from either a story that you're part of or a story that you heard. And that's how opinions happened. When instead of just giving the opinion alone, you tell the story that gives you that cape, that made you have that opinion, that guy gets it. Yeah. That guy also remembers it. And the reason for that is very simple, which is that when we give opinions, we are actually talking to the neocortex part of the brain, which processes language, data, etc. But that's the young brain. Yeah? And it's extremely bad with memory. It's good when we are interacting, and then it forgets. Now, however, when you tell me a story, I visualize. When I told you that story earlier about the Kurg receptionist, did you or did you not visualize two receptionists? Now, your receptionist could be one woman, one man. Mine could be both men. Doesn't matter. You may not have been to Kurg, but you imagined a reception. This went to that part of your brain that does not understand language, but processes visuals and emotions. And this part of the brain has been with man for hundreds and thousands of years. And scientists believe that because of the fact that it's been with us for hundreds and thousands of years, it's been fantastic with memory. So when you can not only appeal to the neocortex, which is dealing with language, but using a story appeal to the part that can remember, because that part doesn't understand language, it understands visuals and emotions, then suddenly not only do you have clarity of the message, you have memorability as well.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So what I would urge you to do is the next time you're driving a opinion at home, which of course you'll do 1,000 times in a day, wait for the one as a starting point. Wait for the one that you really believe in strongly. And before you pontificate on it, just ask yourself, why do I believe this? Whatever that is, it is. Yeah. Why do I believe that? What has happened in my life? Or what have I heard about someone else's life that makes me believe this? And then share that incident along with that opinion and see magic happen.
Fascinating. Lovely. Incidentally, I'd love to move to making this real, right? In the book, I think what I really liked was you talk about how we can make it a practice, right? So I'd love to talk a little bit about that. And the first piece is about the process for gathering gold dust, to use your words. You talk about a very specific approach, and you even get into the specifics of using Evernote as an app. Again, an app that I use quite a bit. Talk to us about what's the discipline here in gathering gold dust?
Now, there are two other things that you touched upon. One is practice, and I'll come to that separately. The second thing you talked about was Evernote. Yeah. I'll not get into too much details in that just now, but if we have to become a storyteller, then we can't be a one-story wonder. You can't think that, oh my God, IC is here, he's going to tell us the Kurg story again. I need to have different stories. And to have different stories, I need to be able to remember different stories. And there's only that many stories I can remember. So we need to find a device. I used to earlier write it down. Now I use Evernote to put in all the stories. And the reason for Evernote and not the Apple Notes is to do with the way our brain stores stories. You see, our brain stores stories indexed on the characters and the plot, but not the message. So for example, if I were to ask you that, you know, tomorrow you have a presentation to make, and in the presentation you're going to make a point that skills and competencies are not a guarantee for success. And I said, Deepak, why don't you use a story everyone will relate to that will drive home the same point? Chances are for most people, no story will pop up. But isn't the hare and tortoise story a story about skills and competencies not being a guarantee for success? Why won't one of the oldest stories that you learned pop up? That's because the brain has stored it under hare and tortoise, or under, you know, the faster animal went to sleep. Yeah. But in business, you don't need the hare and tortoise story. In business, you need the skills and competency story. So not only do we need a database, but we need to index the database very differently than we normally remember. So even if I want to database the hare and tortoise story, which of course in my book I say, you know, don't go there first, stick to factual stories rather than made up. You need to save it indexed as skills and competency. And so Evernote allows tagging of notes. So when you take that story and tag it as skills and competencies, when you later look for it, you will get that story. Because like I said, in business, you'll never need the hare and tortoise story. You'll need the skill and competency story. So that's why Evernote as a practice. So the book has a whole chapter of how to store your stories. And also our YouTube channel has a whole sort of video on how to use Evernote for it. Coming to practice, and you're a musician, so you'll get this. One of the basic issues with practice, and let's talk about me not playing the guitar, despite the fact that I want to play the guitar. I have a guitar that's been sort of traveling with me in the last 4 or 5 houses I've shifted. And that's because of a few things. One is, I've never put in a stake in the ground. Yeah. So a simple little stake in the ground would not be that I would want to rock a concert in Bandra Kurla. Yeah. If the stake in the ground is in my wife's next birthday, I will sing happy birthday on the guitar. That's a stake on the ground. The second is to understand that I have to make baby steps. Yeah. And not sort of give it away as soon as it doesn't sound right. So I pick up the guitar and the first few strings tell me clearly I'll never be Mark Knopfler, and I give it up. But that was not the objective. Right. So if I again said, here's the stake in the ground, I should be able to strum happy birthday in a way that she would recognize it. That's fantastic. So I've put a stake in the ground and I've set up targets for myself, which is achievable. And then, of course, it comes to what I call deliberate practice. I think one of the big things I do not agree with is practice makes perfect. Yeah. You know, to me, the analogy is, imagine that from today, I tell you that I'm going to play badminton in my society every evening. What are the chances that I might actually represent the state? Zero. But every evening, 2 hours for the next 3 years, that's a hell lot of practice. But that's just repeating what I'm doing. And there will be. Will I be better than today? I will get. But then I will have a diminishing return curve. Deliberate practice says, pick up little different parts of the whole and just master that first. Once you master that, then you master the next. So getting back to the badminton analogy, I would say, okay, this month, all I learned to do well is drop shots. And that's all I do. Drop shots, followed by drop shots, followed by drop shots. I go to YouTube, I look up the best way to do drop shots or get myself a coach. I do drop shots. Maybe I video myself and send it to someone saying, am I getting it right? Till I get damn good at drop shots. Next week or next month, I get into smashes. And then next week or next month, I get into serves. That way, I would then pick up and be much better at the game. I still may not represent the state, but I'll be an awesome player.
Got it. And just bringing it back to the world of storytelling, again, if one is trying to build a habit of business storytelling, would you break it into 2 or 3 things that people could be deliberate about? What would you break it into?
So I would go back to, like you said, that I've got these various different kinds of stories or story structures. I would say pick up one of them, right? And just practice that one now and see how it goes. Do it little more and do it little more. And given that business has this huge issue of people saying, no, I can't do it because this is very important. So I can't do it in a client meeting. So what I tell people in my workshops is look for low evaluative, low judgment situations. And there are. I'm talking to my team. That can't be high evaluation, high judgment. Try storytelling there.
Safe spaces, yeah.
Yeah. And I know it will work. Stories work. There is no two ways about it. And when it works, you will get more confidence to try it in a slightly more risky place inside. And instead of trying all of them at one go, pick up each little types of stories that I've taught in the book and try each one by one and then see how that grows. But again, put a stake on the ground. Tell yourself, okay, the town hall that I'm addressing 6 months from now is when I'm going to use 2 stories and I'm going to see how it works. So that's a stake in the ground. Yeah. And I'm going to try out my first kind of stories in my little team meeting next month. Before which I will use the process I tell in the book to bring brevity to that story. Yeah. And by doing all this, which is putting little goals, achievable goals, putting a stake on the ground, doing that practice in little deliberate ways, you can definitely become a storyteller.
Fascinating. And given your experience of having worked with organizations in this field, Adraneel, what's your advice for companies to bring a culture of storytelling into their organizations? Where do they start and how do they go on this journey?
See, I think to start with, there has to be someone in that company, and ideally someone reasonably senior, who starts with a belief that stories work. Yeah. And then the first thing I tell people who come and tell me, I believe stories work, but how do I explain that to my boss? You know, go back to Mahatma Gandhi, which said, be the change you want everyone else to be, start telling stories. When you are going to demonstrate how by telling stories, you are making a difference in your communication, people will start learning. Now, that obviously can't translate to the wider audience. So you do need to get a structured training program. Yeah? Whoever does it. The one thing that I would like people to look at when they're trying to choose how and who do they train with is first is get people from business to teach you business storytelling. Because storytelling is a little alien to most people, or at least there's these labels of stories are for entertainment, stories are for children. When you get a non-business person coming in, my brain is already saying it doesn't work in business.
It's further reinforced.
Oh, that guy's from the theater. Yeah. And when they bring in things like voice modulation, it makes me even more uncomfortable. But if you get a business person coming and telling you, someone who's been in senior positions, has been in board meetings like you have, been in important presentations, is saying you can use it, it brings source credibility. Second, don't look at one-off training programs. I mean, not just for storytelling. I don't think one-off training works any which way. Now, the number of trainings that I've been sent to where at the end of the day, I was pretty convinced this is fantastic. And then I came back and did exactly what I was doing earlier. So make sure that there is a deliberate practice program that you set up. Now, whether that is set up with the person who trained or through your internal sort of processes, whichever, but make sure there's a practice program that is put in place that is calendared and not left to the people deciding whether they want to do it or not. Third, when you're evaluating people who are going to come and deliver training on storytelling, evaluate whether they tell stories. I mean, I had an interesting conversation just the other day with the head of HR who said, you know, I get it, the work you do, I get it, but, you know, you're very expensive. We have a few other people who have come and pitched. I said, you know, you've got to go with who you want to go. Just curious, these other guys who pitched, how many stories did they tell you during their pitch? He thought for a while and said, none. And I said, that's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it? Someone's come to sell you storytelling and hasn't told a single story. So these are some of the things I'd like people to think of. Make sure the person is coming in is not just someone who's got a theory about storytelling, but is able to tell stories. Mm. Yeah. And practice. Set in a process. And this is not really, I might be talking about storytelling because that's one of the things I do, but it could be anything. Design thinking. Just a 2-day design thinking course run by IDEO is not going to make your people design thinkers. There would be 5% who are self-starters who will sort of do their own experiments. But you need to put a deliberate practice program into process.
Got it. Indranil, a couple of questions as we wrap up. Given you're such a keen observer of stories and teller of stories, who are the 3 storytellers you admire in the business world and what about them stands out?
I'll answer the question because I do have favorites. What about them stands out is that they have been natural from whenever. No one has come and taught them. They've been using stories. Yeah. And the first name in India that comes to mind is R. Gopalakrishnan. Now, RG has been a storyteller. I didn't have that label, but I knew was one of the few guys I would actually die to go and listen to, whether he's sort of lecturing my department or my team, doesn't matter. Because I always thought he was very inspirational. But today when I look at it, I know that each of his speeches, each of his presentations were peppered with stories. Now, what are stories? Instead of giving you just the experience, I'm giving you the experience behind that opinion. And so he's very good at it. And as these people have been doing it for some time, they have figured out this thing about brevity. They have figured out how much of the details of the story you need to keep. All the stuff that I teach in the book seems to have come naturally to them. So one is R. Gopalakrishnan. The two other are stuff that, you know, anyone would vote for as being great communicators. Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos. Yeah. Both of whom are intuitively great storytellers. And of course, you know that Bezos has now told that his company has to stop making PowerPoints and use only narrative structures. Those are the 3 names that I would talk
and
about.
And with Steve Jobs, there's clearly that convocation address where he talks about 3 stories that you mentioned in
that's
the book.
That's just
that
one of
out.
Those examples. He has multiple. Yeah, he has this beautiful story that's going up in one of my next videos, the weekly videos that I do, where he talks about how when he was very young, he went into the Yellow Pages and called Bill Hewitt, Hewlett Packard. Yeah, and I don't remember exactly, but I think he was making transistors and he needed some parts. He says those days even the big guy's name was there in the yellow pages in the directory. He just called his direct number and said, "I'm 12 years old. Can I get few spare parts?" And yes, he said yes. And he gave it to me. In fact, later he brought me in to do my summer training there. And I learned so much. And on the transistor line, I learned so much. And because of that, I really believe that one of the difference between people who get it done and people who don't is the ability to ask. He could have just stopped at, Steve, do you have an advice? Yes, people should ask. Don't be afraid of asking. It'll go in through 1 year, it'll go out through the other, I'll never remember. But when he tells a tiny story, did you or did you not imagine a 12-year-old boy picking up a, you know, old telephone and making a call? You did. It went up to that part of your brain that deals with visuals and emotions. And that's why you'll remember the story.
And moving to Bezos, any particular story that stands out?
My favorite is the one that he used in a convocation address. So he says, you know, so Bezos' parents married very early. Yeah. And so the grandparents, what they did was every time Bezos would have a summer holiday, when he was really young, he would go off to the grandparents' farm. Yeah. So when he was around, I think 12, one day, he was in grandparents' farm and they were out for a drive. Grandfather was driving, grandmother was sitting on the co-passenger seat. Jeff Bezos is driving in the back. And the radio is playing some songs and it then has one of those anti-smoking messages. And in this one, the announcer talks about how each puff makes you lose so many minutes in your life. Now, Bezos sits in the back and starts making estimations. He estimates the number of puffs his grandmother takes, because grandmother smokes and is smoking currently in the front seat, and how many puffs she takes to finish a cigarette, how many cigarettes she has in a day, how many years she has been smoking. And at some point, he pops his head in front and says, "Grandma, with that last cigarette, you just lost 7 years, X days, X hours of your life." And he said the next reaction was something I didn't expect, because I expected them to turn and say, "Jeff, you're so intelligent. You did that in your head?" Instead, my grandma just broke down crying. And my grandpa parked the car on the side of the road. He got out and called me out. I didn't know what to expect because, you know, he's never raised his voice. Forget raising his arm. He walked me a little further from the car and then he said, "Jeff, someday when you grow up, you'll figure out that it is much harder to be kind than to be clever. And that's what you need to work on." And he gives this advice to people graduating in that convocation address. What a powerful story. Yeah, I, for one, will never forget it. Now, he could have said, it's important as you become business managers going out, just because you've graduated from this fancy university, you think cleverness is the only important thing, you need to be kind. It would have gone through 1 year, gone out of the other. But as he told the story, it stuck.
Fascinating. It's been a really inspiring conversation, Indraneel, inspiring at multiple levels. This podcast is titled Play to Potential. So in conclusion, what do you want to leave the listeners with for them to play to the potential?
See, all of us have a lot of messages that could be our unique understanding into a situation, a problem, etc. Unless we find ways that translates into a way that people get it, can remember it, and share it with another five people, that worth of the message is lost. So you have the potential to change people's mind, change the way a whole organization works or a team works, because you have an insight into something that is different from someone else. Yeah. But your ability to communicate that is going to make the difference between whether it was just an idea or whether it was action. And one of the easier way to do it is to use stories and story structures.
Lovely. Pleasure, Indraneel. Thanks so much for making the time and for coming all the way.
As I said earlier, thanks for having me. I loved having the conversation as well. Thank you.
Lovely.
I hope you found the conversation purposeful. I'm reminded of one of the offsites I was at when I was at Egon Zehnder. This must have been around 2012 or 2013, when Rajiv Vasudeva, the co-founder of Egon Zehnder in India, was appointed as the global CEO. We were in Goa, and Rajiv attended the offsite and decided to share the story of him starting Egon Zehnder. He spoke about how he met his other co-founder Sanjeev Sachar and how they decided to start a consulting firm on their own. He spoke about how they stumbled upon executive search and how the desire to partner with a global organization got them writing to several search firms, and eventually they decided to tie up with Egon Zehnder in India. He went on to speak about his early days in the office, where he would be the consultant and the peon at the same time. He spoke about one particular instance when the rainwaters had flooded the office floors and how he had to sweep the office because there was a client meeting the next morning. He spoke about some of the early sacrifices he and his partner Sanjeev made and how they went after their initial clients and people they worked with. He must have spoken impromptu for about 45 minutes on his journey, and we all listened in rapt attention. The only sound apart from his voice was the sound of the waves. Through his story, he touched upon things like entrepreneurship, excellence, putting clients first, collaboration, and several other things that were core at Egon Zehnder, while he didn't spell them out that way. But that was the first time for me I had experienced a story from an authentic place that left a mark on me and drove home a lot of points around corporate culture, something a precise PowerPoint hadn't done till then. If I may bring it back to what Indranil says, when we share from our lives, when we are authentic in how we share, and we become vulnerable, then people start relating to us differently, and the level of trust you build suddenly goes up a notch, whether it's at home or at work. My next guest at the podcast is Tarun Khanna, a professor at Harvard Business School. He talks about his recently published book, Trust, Creating the Foundation of Entrepreneurship in Developing Countries. He talks about how entrepreneurs in emerging markets often have to create the conditions to create, apart from focusing on their business.
And one interesting thing about both these instances of Devi Shetty's Heart Hospital and of microfinance firms around the world, right? If you pose the simple question to, let's say, a classroom of 100 undergraduates or 100 CEOs of companies or 100 policymakers in any country, and you say, how many of you think that it is absolutely and categorically unethical to make money by selling services to the poor? That's one extreme position. The other extreme position is, how many of you have no problem at all saying that as long as you follow the law and are ethical in all possible respects, in letter and spirit, if you can make money by selling to the poor, you have no issues with a company being very profitable. So two extreme positions. And I tell the students that they cannot hedge their bets. They cannot be both. They cannot be in the middle. You have to choose one or the other. The split is invariably 50-50. Invariably. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, Wall Street types, or as we say in Delhi, jholawalas, you know, stereotypically JNU people. Doesn't matter. No matter who you pitch this to, it will be 50-50. So it appears that all of us, my hypothesis as an academic is to say that we appear to have evolved pretty hardwired notions in our heads of what is legitimate and not legitimate to do with catering to the poor, bringing the market to serve the poor. And again, I say in my class that it's not for me to make value judgments. I wear my heart on my sleeve, and my actions tell you where I stand on this debate. But if, you know, you and your God have a different answer, then, God be with you. Go for it.
Thank you for your time and for your listening. And I look forward to having you at another conversation of the Play to Potential podcast. Signing off, this is Deepak Jayaraman. To know more about the coaching and transition advisory work I do, please visit transitioninsight.com. Bye now.